Welcome to Terragrams. Hi, I'm Craig Verzone, and I'll be your host for the 18th delivery of Terragrams. Today, we will talk to the Dutch landscape architect Michael van Gezel. Michael has been honing his work in the landscape for over three decades and has produced a wide body of work ranging from private gardens to urban planning projects. He was born in Bandung, Indonesia, part of the former Dutch Indies, and has also lived in Paris and Australia. At the Agricultural College of Wengingen, he has earned a BA in plant disease, landscape architecture, as well as an MA in landscape architecture. In 1977, he joined firm Bureau Bakker and Blieker, now B&B, and eventually directed the office from 91 to 1997. Since 97, he has been enjoying self-employment and independent consulting. An exhibition of his work was a focus of this year's Triennale of Landscape in the Dutch city of Apeldoorn, and coinciding with the event was the release of a self-entitled monograph of his work. Michael was a finalist for the Rosa Barber Prize of the 5th Biennale of Landscape in Barcelona. We are very happy to be joined by Michael van Gezel. Michael, thank you so much for taking your time out of the day, and thank you for joining us at Terragrams.
You're welcome.
You have a new monograph, your first monograph, that overviews 30 years of your work. It's quite a significant book, both in size but also in content. It's entitled Invisible Work, and it compiles a series of very well-written essays together with some beautiful photos, and then it's sort of backloaded with some fantastic, your sketches, your drawings. My first question is, in the profession, you're a landscape architect, a profession which often lacks visibility. Can you talk a little bit about the idea that the title of your book is invisible, and how that might pose a certain complexity to the field of landscape architecture, or your position within the field of landscape architecture?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I never thought of that in that relationship, must say. No. I don't have any. I see here in Barcelona, where we're having this interview, is that there is still very much the discussion of the visibility of landscape architects as a profession and as a profession in its own worth or in its own power towards architects. In Holland, we don't have that. That's long past. I'm now working 30 years, and I never feel that in that way. I feel very much acknowledged. I feel very much part of the world. I work a lot with architects, and the two professions respect each other very much. But I see also that in other countries, there's a difference in that attitude. So I never had that in that relationship. But the invisible work, to come to the title of the book, is because I find it a very great compliment if people come into a project I've executed and they say, don't see anything, haven't seen. What have you done here? It is as though it's always been there. I love that the work I make is not about a pronunciation of look at me, look what I have done, how clever I am in designing or whatever. No, I want it to fit the landscape or the landscape or the cityscape or whatever scape it is in. And at the same time, fit in its use of how people use it, how people experience their environment. And I think I consider it a great compliment if people feel it's always been there and it fits. Mm-hmm. And that's very much very important for landscape architects, that you are grounded. That is, we were talking this morning about the transition or about this nostalgia and about people thinking very much that's important. History is becoming very important, sort of a marketing history and tradition, a marketing purpose. But I think the world transforms continuously, and transformation in itself is lovely. That doesn't mean you have to keep the old, but you have to transform the old in something new. The word transformation means really old and new are indistinguishable. Old and new blend into a new whole. Mm-hmm. With respect of the old, but with addition of new, and that addition, the word addition is not good, it is blended into, it's like, so very natural it is blended in. That's the real meaning of transition, not tabula rasa, not starting anew, not keeping one little part and drawing the rest and adding something, but really blending it all together. And that I find fascinating. That's how cities work, that's how landscapes work in a slower space, but that's how our environment is transforming to our needs of today and our promises for tomorrow, maybe I say, can I say that like that, or what we would like tomorrow to be.
But when you intervene in the landscape, you must certainly have some idea that you'd like to make something visible or something more visible.
Lots of my projects I articulate. I think lots of landscapes are very become a green soup, or they're very dispersed or very fragmented. So when I do a project, I first look at the. It sounds very New Age, but it is. I always do it on my own. So often there are people around, but then when I always take time, maybe a day, maybe 3 days. To really soak in the environment where I'm working at. I really want to get to know it. And I'm with complete quietness and complete solitude. I look at what is there, how it speaks to me. And then from that, I integrate the new purposes and new uses, but especially I try to enhance the specific qualities and the beauty of that space. So in that way, to articulate it means that it's not what's gone is gone, but what is articulated, what is there more prominent than before, fits because it was already there.
Do you have to sleep in your landscapes beforehand?
No, I don't have to
no
sleep.
Camping.
No camping, but I've never done that. But I've been staying for 3 days at a place because I could go into a hotel or whatever.
In these first moments when you're on site, are you just looking or are you also designing?
No, I design. No.
Are you sketching?
No, I'm not sketching. I'm very much looking, but always in movement. I never sit or I never stare. Maybe I sit for a moment, because landscape is also, that's why it's so difficult to draw it. That's why it's also so difficult to make perspective, because there's only one point of view. And landscape is you experience landscape in movement. You experience it in the rhythm of how you walk through it, or how you cycle through it, or how you drive through it. It's all different rhythms. You have to take all those three things into account. So, I move. Go one side and then I go the other side, and I first move around it and then in it and then again around it. So it depends. Sometimes it's just an afternoon because it's a small project, or 2 hours, but always have to do that. Otherwise I feel footloose. I don't feel not grounded. I feel like I'm swimming.
And when you get back to the office, do you have only the memory of the landscape, or you also recorded the landscape in other ways?
No, I've made photos, but it's also mostly photos, photographed the landscape, and I hardly use it because it's in my brain. Then I hardly go back, but I do go back with the first sketches, and I look again, and I go back, and then I walk, and then I know what the sketches are and what I want to change. Don't go literally with the sketch, but I know, or the plan, but I know what I want to know, and then I look again and I see if it's feasible what I think. Because it's often also different if you know what you want to do, how you want to intervene.
How you want to position your idea.
Yeah.
In your monograph, one of the essays talks about your process as a combination between analysis and intuition.
Yes.
Where and when do they start and stop? And clearly may not be so simple as that. How do they overlap?
The analysis is already an intuition, because you can analyze something in very different ways. So when I start analyzing and I start drawing, I always draw the analysis. I draw it in a certain fashion, and I notice that I don't ever do it the same way. It depends very much on the project how I do it. Because I think this is about space, or this is about ecology, how it works in an ecological manner, or this is about how people use a space. So, for instance, a piazza or whatever, then I just look how people use it at this moment and what's wrong with it, where it stocks and why it's empty on one side. So it can be very different than that I make a pattern of use or I made a pattern of evening or day. It depends very much what topics I need. And so it's always different, but I try analyzing is more or less dissecting. Is that a word in English? Mm-hmm. Dissecting, like you have a piece of bone or a cow which you slaughtered, and then you have to dissect it in bones and certain parts. And that's how you do it. And sometimes it's very different. It depends on the animal. Mm-hmm. So it depends on the project how you do it. Mm-hmm. That's more or less how I say it. And so it's never a certain man. And so the intuition is already in there because I. And then I just, there are chance things that happen. And chance must be, it's not for nothing, again, maybe very new age, but I feel very much that things happen because they happen at that moment. And I feel that is inspiring. It's not always literally taken, but it inspires me. Also, if I draw, then something, yeah, I'm busy with another project and that inspires the first one, or I suddenly have an insight and then I use things that are from other projects in this project, which mm-hmm. has nothing to do with each other. But because I think of it, because mm-hmm. it suddenly has a flash of, he said, can be in the shower in the morning mm-hmm. and I quick can't wait to run upstairs to my office and test it.
So you're not organizing your ideas or your flashes of inspiration via project, letting them
something, but it sounds as though I'm very frivolous and just letting things go. But I've learned that I was very mathematical when starting my profession 30 years ago. I was more insecure, and then I was thinking I have to analyze. And also in Wageningen, where I studied, there was a great emphasis on analyzing it correctly. We had all Ian McHarg and all those then. And it was all about analyzing and getting it into.
So the science of the landscape was fundamental.
Science, more science. Mate of Rome was very much our professor, very much a mm-hmm. scientist and very much a functionalist. So it took me a long time to free myself from that, and I gradually trust more my intuition. Intuition is also about trusting yourself, mm-hmm. trusting your own experience. It's about trust, and that's a gradual process. And that's why I feel every time, I don't know if that's in the book, but I've worked 30 years, but people of my generation who did other professions than mine when we were studying at the university, they're all retiring, and I said, I'm just beginning. At last, I feel free to do exactly.
Right.
I know where the balance is between right. analyzing and intuition.
How do you know when you get a good idea?
It fits, feels good. It fits. It's just, yeah. It is not about idea. It is about it's not much of an idea. Never have that bright idea. It's more that I go into the project and sometimes it doesn't work and doesn't regret. I don't know, working on the Kirchenhof, that's that flower, you know, that huge world famous flower exhibition, which next door is the old castle. Mm. And it's sometimes very difficult and then I can't find anything, but then I just, I'm there for a day and then just draw and analyze and try and then suddenly all the process of the last 3 hours of work fit mm-hmm. suddenly because I'm searching and searching about all and then I start here again and then I think of that and then it gradually grows and suddenly things fit.
So is it usually a seed that gets planted and it just needs to grow or can
no,
you
it's not a
also
seed,
have
really.
Some spontaneous
is, yeah.
some no, it's spontaneous sudden. Birth that happens?
Yeah, good. Yeah, that can happen, and then suddenly, but it can be a little seed somewhere that the spontaneous seed, mm-hmm. and then suddenly all the other things fit. There's a child, a little element born, mm-hmm. and that makes that, and it's sometimes something very different that doesn't come out of the sight, it comes out of the mind, and then suddenly other things fit. And where that comes from is a mystery. Lovely, huh? There's still mysteries in this world.
We need to hold on to some of
to
our
mysteries.
Mysteries.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. and. But the it is about Craig. It is about. I come more and more aware that it is about. How to explain that? An open mind, an open attitude, not to have too much in advance to know what or to want. I don't want things. I just try to fit sight with the command that's made or the desire that society that's very legitimate wants to do something about it or just wants to repair it, whatever they want, and just let to see those both things happen together and just let it happen. And I'm just a catalysator or maybe a stimulator or moderator between the two. And of course there's all this own attitude and because my work is has a sort of handwriting. The handwriting is a speciality, but space, simplicity, long lines, that sort of thing. So I have that tendency, but I start always trying to listen to that element at first.
Have you had any sites or any projects which lacked a certain clarity in their history or lacked a certain value historically or ecologically that gave you a tabula rasa to begin? And if so, how do you take the science to the white paper?
I'm thinking, but I can't remember that really, that it's a completely tabula rasa.
I thought maybe the private garden would be better an example to look
towards. Something, but then the private garden has a relationship with the interior. Mm-hmm. It's not the garden itself, but it's how you get into the garden or how you look into the garden or how you enter it. Mm-hmm. So,
and maybe the client has a certain preconception.
And the client
as well.
The client wants something very, very low maintenance or a very hard attitude. So then you look at it differently. And it's always something. There is always something. Even the horizon, the sky, it's there. Or the light in Holland is different light than here in Spain. So it's very, very different. There's always something. Mm-hmm. Even when I'm working also on the IJburg, which is a new suburb in the water in the IJmeer near Amsterdam, and there's only sand. But then the edges of that sand and how it meets the water and what you can do with the form of that and how form, sometimes things happen by accident, can also with the sand that's just put there, and then you have suddenly something that nobody intended to be of a form or design, but you find that in the situation, not intentionally, and I use that. Mm-hmm. Suddenly I see beauty in it from a certain angle or something. It's just the open mind to what is there. Mm-hmm.
I believe that more and more as a profession, we're going to be charged with and we're going to need to find and construct new natures. Do you share this belief? And if so, where do we begin to come up with these new natures and where are they best positioned?
I don't know if we desire a new nature. The more problem is that we have to respect what is there already, the nature that's left. But I do find also a great positive feeling, a great sort of a new, is that nature, which was not intended to nature, so industrial landscapes, wastelands, have a huge beauty suddenly, or have this, because of the complete alienness of that element in the landscape. I'm now working at a dump, but only so that gives sort of new perspective for new nature, and it's already there because of the, so there are that sort of thing. But the problem is for humankind is more that what worries me, not nature, but how we blend nature with urbanism and agriculture use. Mm-hmm. Is very difficult. I mean, our landscape, we always forget, and discussions are often about urban and nature and urban land or landscape and green or and red and urban and nature. But that's not the landscape, because nature is the difficulty, and often the sort of fights are between agriculture agrarians who uses the first century this nature and have been the protector of nature. Not always, they have also been the abusers of nature with all the DDT and read Silent Spring, which is of the 50s or 60s. We abuse nature and we tend now, and this is a human sort of thing, to zone our things. This is nature, that's agricultural production, and here we are, can live. And what is really for us in future is to blend. You can have landscapes which have all three. You don't have to live always in cities, but you can also disperse people into the landscape and have a very good quality of life in collaboration with agriculture and with nature, because nature is always about zoning, about wetlands which are interconnected, and there are also elements where you can really do something else. Mm-hmm. It's always this here we can do, and then the people feel free to do anything without any respect of what was there before, and on the other hand they sort of worship, look what we have left over of this beautiful natural park. Mm-hmm. And at the border of the natural park it's dreadful. Mm-hmm. It's completely a free state. Mm-hmm. You can do whatever you want, and that sort of thinking, it's politically very, very, it is very understandable from a political point of view, because we need these plans and zoning and that we have done, but it is in a philosophical sense, it is wrong that we think in these zones.
You mentioned industrial wasteland or yes. Industrial transformation. What happens when our farming, or Europe's farming, evolves and begins to shrink? The territory of farming begins to shrink.
Yeah, it's happening.
What kind of role do we as landscape architects have in trying to reformulate that vegetally or yeah. programmatically or administrationally? How can we participate in the change of Europe's agricultural landscape?
By thinking of this transformation, that's also a process. The transformation is not only always a spatial effect, it's also the use of it. So it's not only about space, but also about use. And that's why I think it's also worrisome, because it changes really our landscapes, because it is the agricultural use gives a specific image of the landscape. And landscape architects can make people, like Gilles Clément did this morning, and what I think is he does very well, is make people aware of our responsibility in those matters. And why I say it worries me is because it's not shrinking, but that the fact is that people who live on the land don't have enough income. And that's not because the consumers are not willing.
We're eating less.
Not eating less, but we there's in the in between the marketing and all that takes all that energy out, because they earn too little to really make a living out of it, and that means that it's become all industrialized, and that's another problem is that our food is so very dilapidated or it's very tasteless because of all these warehouses where we produce it. And that's again a question of prices and whatever. Mm-hmm. But so I'm sometimes I feel also it's beyond us, because it's all about economy and of this big money and going on a European level also. And on the other hand, I'm a positive person, and so I think we should also show and continue to advocate the respect for nature and the people who manage it. Not only on a natural level, but also on a private level as agrarians.
And a regional level.
Yeah, and a regional level. And
because the farmers are, in fact, managing much more of the landscape than landscapers are.
And so I think also it's very good in Holland, we now have this, that we substitute, that if farmers have a woodland in it and they manage it as they used to do it all the time, and it's now completely abandoned, that we pay them to manage it. So that's also a sort of a real income for them, because they're doing something that's for the society as a whole,
right.
Something of benefit. So I don't see anything wrong in that, because on the other hand, if only nature conservation organizations, they're very bureaucratic, to be honest, because there's also another thing, is the groundedness. There's another thing in society that people are taking care of nature who have very little connection, real connection, rooted connection to nature, because they're not living in it,
right.
They're thinking about it, they're very bureaucratic, this organization can be very, so I'm also advocating in Holland that there are many different sort of organizations, not one huge big organization that takes care of our natural monuments, as we call them, natural areas, but many, because then you have more diversity also in management ideas, because they change also continuously.
Do you think it's possible to find a balance between the ecological terrain, or the terrain that's most affected or most necessary for our ecological systems, and our agricultural terrain, which is necessary for our food, and our sort of urban vegetal terrain, which is necessary for our leisure? We have overlaps between these, but do you think we can, will be able to find a healthy balance here?
I think it's not a question of will. We have to find a balance. It is. We have to balance it. So it's not. That's a continuous fight about how to balance all those three things, and it demands an attitude of not being secure, but always not being rigid. Mm-hmm. And politicians, which have and long run the say, to educate them that you can do all three at one time, but that's also what we can show them, that those things are feasible. And the feasible, that's what I wanted to say also, landscape architects should learn not to interfere, because we are a profession that interferes by definition, because we are asked to do a project. And the thing is to do as little as possible and to listen what sometimes you can do something very little, which is the maximum effect, to be conscious of how our landscape is used by the difference, and on the other hand, ecologists, we all experience that ecologists who design is terrible, because ecologists design ecological design, so it's always squiggling around, and it's always it's very Rudolf Stein with all the, so it's terrible designing, and so it is a fall to think that design is contrary to ecological. Ecology is about maintenance and how that you maintain it always in the same way, and design is about differences. So you can design things, and it could be easily a straight line, but be ecologically very interesting. But the two intermingle not well. And the other side, farmers. When I work in real large scale projects, farmers, there's also a very great difference in the education of farms. Some are very rigid and are really only in production, and others are very broad-minded and know what to do if they also have another. So it's always, you always look for people who have this broad mind and see in this perspective of different ways of use. Because the users also with recreational, there are all these recreational sociologists in Holland, so they say we have to do it like that. The only thing I always advocate is open up the landscape, make paths. That's all we need. We don't need all these green stars, as they said in the 60s in Holland. We don't need all these recreational areas. What are we doing? People saying what to do, swim, jog, play football here. No, we just want to open up. We want to leave our cities and cycle, or go by car, or walk into the landscape. Mm-hmm. And then there's more than enough. Mm-hmm. Not needed all these infrastructure. No, we need the infrastructure, very small and intricate infrastructure for the slow movers. And we don't need all these huge parks and everything.
How can we intervene in a very light fashion, as you're suggesting, and put the landscape into a framework where it's appeared to be highly valuable and not so fragile for mutation or change or sort of further development?
Another time, I have to think really what you're asking.
Often, if the landscape isn't clearly articulated, it loses its value and becomes very fragile to further development. How can we sort of create these light interventions that make it clear that the landscape one enters into is to be valued?
Yeah, I think it's in different countries different. I'm speaking about my experience in Holland, is that it's different from the United Kingdom, is that you have these landscapes which are very inaccessible because of the water we have also. You can't just jump the fence. It's all these ditches. So it is we have been an agricultural economy up till now, mm-hmm. Although it's not also industrial and but it has a very powerful economic basis in agriculture. It tends to be very well maintained and very close society. And the thing is that it is a fight against the ecologists who want more and more terrain. They buy all hectares for that, and then there's the fight. And while I think it is more the blending of it, and that takes communication. It's communication between the two mm-hmm. different, and that's always very difficult. If you tend to be in your own world, it's much easier than trying to communicate with mm-hmm. another world. So these interventions are fragile, but I believe they are very important. And it doesn't mean, I did once a project also with where they wanted to invest in a landscape. It was near Amsterdam, and it was this was really quite a long time ago, at least 20 years ago. And we said, don't do anything. They said, yes, we must make it into a woodland, mm-hmm. because that's the only way that people won't use this for a building, mm-hmm. because open land is always available. Open meadows are also always elements where you can build. Mm-hmm. And a wood is when you have to cut the trees, that's very difficult. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to, and the landscape asks, it's a real Dutch, peat landscape, which doesn't want woodland. Mm-hmm. So we won the fight and invested in all sorts of little places where you could sit mm-hmm. and stay for a while. But that was a huge turnover. It means very much in the thinking of the people who worked in the recreation field.
So these points of sitting were like little fortress, yes, outposts, just, yeah, outposts to protect the yeah. open
and they
space
were really they were also designed like little fortresses, just mm-hmm. places where you can picnic mm-hmm. or just stand still or, mm-hmm. or be for a while, and then you just cycle or walk on.
Mm-hmm. You were listening to Terragrams, and our guest is Michael van Gezel. Michael, a Dutch landscape architect, is a self-employed independent advisor of landscape architecture and urban planning. In the fall of 2008, he was a finalist for the Rosa Barber Prize of the 5th Biennale of Landscape in Barcelona. You're clearly still in the thick of your practice and yeah. sort of continuing on.
Yeah.
How do you structure your office? And are you independent, or are you working with others?
No, I've worked 18 years for B&B. I was and I worked in that office, and it's a very successful office, and we were very much together with other landscape architects, and I loved that work. It was very it was very stimulating, because mm-hmm. I think discussing projects together is very important. So I like doing that. But I did it for 18 years, and last years I was director, so I really was responsible for the acquisition of projects and to sell the project and to get the whole, so it took, I was at last 40% of my time was management, and 60% of the time I was coaching the other mm-hmm. designers. So, and how, maybe I was designing one or two projects at a time, so very little. So in the long run, I thought I want to start all over again and really design myself and really be on a project, because that's where my heart is. Because management, many people can manage. I mean, the world is filled with managers, but designers or landscape architects with a certain sensitivity are much less. So I thought I must go back to my profession. So that's why I decided to go on my own, and I'm on my own. I'm really on my own. I'm office one man. Oh yeah, I have an assistant. I have a personal assistant who works for me. And then who sort of coordinates the things, I really, my office. Mm. And for the rest, I hire everybody, just people, contractors, but also people who do the technical part of the work, who make my booklets, who draw the CAD/CAM drawings, whatever. Mm. But also, I mean, if I have now an exhibition of my work in Apeldoorn, I find a very young bloke that I thought, I look around, and it's a very young man, and he I saw an exhibition. I thought, oh wow, this is lovely. If I ever have a chance, and then I got this chance of doing the exhibition, and I immediately rang him. Said, you don't know me, but I know your work. So come on, let's do it. So I like to do it that way, and people are autonomous. It's sort of. Later on, I thought, oh, this is really a network office. It was very modern, but I didn't think of that at all when I started it.
Did it come to you as a flash to leave B&B and to...
No, when I became director, I knew what I was in for. And the directors before me were also about 7 years doing it. And I thought, I'd do it 7 years. I had difficulty leaving. I found it very nice because I had difficulty... Two things. I had difficulty leaving this practice, which was very successful and had very international projects, was working all over the world. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was... sort of also very Peter Stuyvesant, you know, the world of getting everywhere. And so I thought I will be in sort of quiet area and maybe I have to do gardens again or maybe that sort of thing. So I was anxious about that. And I loved coaching these people, these young people. It's lovely to see people grow in their... It's lovely to see somebody who say what you want to do. And I thought that that was very nice about managing, that you see people finding their niche and growing into good architects, you know. That's very nice to see that. But...
Do you miss working together?
Yes, that's it. No, but it was completely different. That's what the thing, because it's nobody asks ever if I have an office of 20 people behind. They don't seem to mind. They just give these huge assignments, and I say mostly say no, and sometimes I say yes, and then I organize them. But what did you want to ask? Excuse me. I
was if you miss the collegiality.
No,
but
I don't miss that because I discuss it with the commissioners. I'm mostly and Craig. I'm doing half of the time landscape architect, the other half of architecture, the other half of the time. I'm a supervisor for huge urban plans, so I'm always continuously in meetings and discussing the state of the art with all sorts of, and mostly that's very interesting because I'm on these boards with sociologists, urban planners, architects, landscape architects, ecologists, depends very much on the project, and these are huge discussions all the time on a hugely high level, so I always think I'm being paid for a lovely education.
Do you find it hard to make the voice of the landscape clear?
No, I don't find it hard, but I continuously, people say, you're really so demanding and you're so clear about what you think, but I don't, I just speak from the heart, but apparently I'm very forceful. Apparently you can't get around me. I said, this is the way to do it or not. And apparently that's better, but I'm not very conscious of that. I get that feedback, but when I'm at the project and when I'm supervising, I do it with my complete heart, and not much do it with my mind. With I listen, but then I really speak. How do I feel about this? If I don't feel right about it, then I really speak it out. And sometimes not clear why I don't feel right about it, but then I say I don't feel right about it, and then together with the rest of the group, we find out why. No, I feel free because I'm also free. That's so lovely about life, isn't it, Craig? Because you have free. You can say whatever you want. And if they don't like it, then they just leave it. I always take this. Sometimes people say also, don't you think it's awful if your advice is not followed? I said, I think it's very stupid if my advice is not so. You pay for an advice and then you don't follow it. That's very stupid to do that.
I want to go back a little bit in time. The Park Lavalette competition, by my counts, has been the most referred to benchmark in contemporary landscape architecture.
The what about
Park Lavalette?
Yeah. Oh, that's a long time. Yeah.
And was won by an architecture firm, and second prize also went to an architecture firm. And you were working on one of the, you worked on a scheme with B&B, Bakker and Bleeker at the time, that won the first round. Won the first prize in the first round.
Ex-Aequo. There were 9 plans ex-Aequo. Yeah.
Was this really a pivotal moment in contemporary history of landscape architecture? And what were your feelings when you heard the results that Bernard Tschumi's project won and that the OMA project was second in comparison to the work that your team had produced? So was it a real, was it really a turning point in history?
It was.
Or is it just a benchmark that we refer back to? And then what were your feelings personally about the results of the competition, the decisions of the jury, and then finally what it actually produced?
Yeah. I don't think it's a turning point, but it is a benchmark. It is a, it was a, it was really, you know, the period before and after. What was, you must think, it was economically not a very good time. At that moment, it was Europe was in a recession. So it was very little built. So the whole world submitted a plan for, I mean, for now, but at that time, about, I think about 500, 600 plans, or 400, so nearly 500 plans, and very well, you know, you had to really study it and draw. I mean, it was huge amount of work. So that was a huge amount of energy worldwide went into it. So, and it was not because of the speciality of that project, well, that certain part of it, because in Paris and because it was advertised as the park of the 21st century. So there were certain things that were special, but it didn't demand that amount of attention. But because of the economic situation, many people thought, this is our chance. And we were a young officer, we thought also, this is our chance. We did the utmost, that's always lovely about competitions in an office, because you discuss it thoroughly. And for weeks and months, I think we worked on it 3 months, every evening and every weekend, to get this project done. And it was a huge project. I loved that process, and I loved the thoughts that we were behind it, and why we wanted it in a way. And landscape architect that moment was still quite a sort of a soft greenery profession of parks, and this demanded really a very urbanistic view, a built view. It was green, but it was about urbanism. It was, how do we transform this old abattoir terrain into a city, a green city, but the program demanded also a lot of building. So it was really more an urbanist plan, a green urbanist planning assignment, than a park in its traditional sense. So that made it interesting. We were flabbergasted, I must say, or completely. We got the message that there were 9 prizes ex aequo, and then we thought, how lovely! And we got telegrams at that time. We didn't have these emails and everything, so we got telegrams, and everybody was so happy that the Dutch office was one of them. And then we went for the briefing for the second round, and then we saw all the. It was only later that we envisioned that the 9. The exception about the 9 was that they looked at this project as an urban project, as a city which has a city thinking of the city and its urban attitude and urban environment took hold of this dilapidated grounds of the old abattoir of La Villette, instead of making a park which is in an element in itself. No, the city was. You made a project that allowed the city to take possession of that area.
To grow into
that area, exactly. And all the 9 had that. That was so lovely. Mm-hmm. And at first you think, everybody's inventing this. You always think, but many made all sorts of plans and all sorts of design and whatever there was. So that was the special thing, so those 9. Then we had the discussion and the presentations, and then I must say that I was there because I did it with Rick Bakker. We did it together there because of the French. I can speak French and English, and it was in the French and English language. So we did it together, and I was very much, to be honest, very much in favor of Rem Koolhaas' plan, because I thought Rem Koolhaas was close to ours. Ours was much greener, but the sort of more inspiring, I thought, his, but the whole structure, exactly the same, one straight line and bands like that, and his drawings were exceptionally well done, and he's a genius, so I thought he did very well, and I would have loved him to get that assignment. I thought Tschumi was a bit feminine, to say, not as a person, but as a plan.
Right.
All these, the very postmodern, and at that time I saw a bit fussy. Is that a good word?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a good word, but can you understand it in connection with this very postmodern plan? And there was a big, huge fight at that moment that Chumi had changed his main plan, because he didn't have the straight line going from north to south, and all the others had it except Chumi. Uh-huh. And he changed an essential part.
In the second round.
Yeah, because he saw that all the others had that line, so he did that and changed it in the second round. And you were not allowed to change the main plan, you were only allowed to elaborate on your plan. And so there was a great discussion. I thought, now what are this all people about procedure? And of course it is. It isn't the plan of the 21st century. Wilhelm Kohlhaas was the plan of the 21st century because it's open-minded. Chumi is not an open-minded plan, it's a very closed plan. It's a plan of the times, it's the plan of the 80s, it's a postmodern plan. But it wasn't at that moment, it was a very contemporary, extremely contemporary plan. It was not a plan of the next
century. So it's not the Mies van der Rohe pavilion of its time?
No, not at all, no.
And do you... Have you visited it?
Yes, I've visited it, and I think it's very French. I hope I don't hurt them, but it's very French. It's very extremely formal. I dislike that formality. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, it has lovely spots and it has lovely elements and there are gardens in it but it's so over the top, OTT, very OTT, very over the top and very formal and very. I wonder if it will keep its time because it's a monument of the times.
Now, yes.
So it will keep it, but it is, and I gather it is a success, but it is in whirlwind of it. It is still successful because it is very much a green area, but it could have been much more successful, spatially. Mm.
You and a handful of your Dutch contemporaries recently took a tour of the United States.
Oh, you're very well informed.
How great was that experience?
It was lovely.
And what drove you all, or propelled you all to take a few weeks? How much time?
Two and a half weeks, nearly 3 weeks. I live in a country which has a wonderful attitude towards culture. In some ways, we have, I mean, it's not in America, and they were amazed that we could all go. We have two foundations. It's maybe nice to explain. We have one foundation of stimulating architecture in a broader sense. So people, commissioners can do all sorts of initiative like a book or an exhibition, or they want a certain municipality wants a plan and wants to ask three or four offices, and they can't pay for it, and so they can get stimulated. They do ask for five offices of great quality to submit a plan because that's four times as expensive. So that's to stimulate on the commissioner side, stimulate the art, and that we tend to think about new ways and stimulate architects. The other part is individually, people, architects, designers, artists, landscape architects, and urbanists can apply for funding of anything they want to do. They can study at Harvard, and then they say, I want money to have that. And then if the quality of that person is good, if the motivation is good, they get the money, period. So you can do it on an individual basis, whatever you want. So that's very democratic, because it's the initiative lies in the person, and people tend to do all sorts of very strange things. So I think those two methods are very good, that we have that. It's wonderful. That last fund always organizes, I'm elaborating, if it's too long, then you just say it's great. They elaborated on always, they saw that many people asked for grants to do a study trip. And then they invented thought maybe we should organized, and they always were very expensive, those, because they went all the way over the place. So then they said, we do this in a group, and we organize one, we keep that people want but we also organize it ourselves, and every time it's a different topic and a different country. So we were once already in Los Angeles with the group 12 years ago or 11 years ago, and we went to Brazil in another time, and the group went to Japan and all the East European countries with a certain topics, because then every time, so shrinking cities, etc. So it's always a topic. This time they went, the first time it was specific for landscape, or about landscape architecture, and in because of, we were talking this morning about Olmsted, the whole movement in America, the movement of landscape is much older. Landscape architecture in Holland was, and the schooling was very much fit towards the American system, because in the 50s America was already had landscape architecture, had schooling in landscape. In Holland it didn't exist at that moment, so that comes very much from the new country. So that, and the difference in scale between the gardens or city ecology right up to the Grand Canyon was something that we don't experience so much in Europe. So we wanted that interrelationship. They, and the thing is that you apply, the wonderful thing is why it's only America was nice to visit, but also the way we were with, I think, two artists, two landscape photographers, two urbanists, only three landscape architects, landscape critics, an economist. So very, very diverse group, art critics. So it was a very different group, and that makes it very interesting, because it's about listening to the Americans wherever we're, and looking at the thing, and the reactions of the different professions are so different. So this, the discussion within the group, which is even more beneficial in our thinking than most of the discussions with the people who gave the lecture. And it's very intensive. Huh? Mm-hmm. I mean, you get the grant and they pay for everything, but you really have to work. It's no fun. Yeah, it's lots of fun, but you really have to work day and night. So it's very time, but it's a learning curve from here
where
to there.
Where did you go?
We went from New York. We went New York, Washington, Williamsburg, back to Washington, then Chicago, to the prairie and the city and the... And then we went to the Grand Canyon. That's a lovely trip. Very, very diverse. And very good to speak also with the professionals, the professionals and the differences in the professionals in the United States, as you know very well. There are very different attitudes. And Europe tends to see the United States very much as one very capitalistic and very homogeneous country, which is, of course, it's not, but it's always the attitude of people who don't travel. Relativity comes from meeting and communication, and there's this huge difference in attitude between the different professionals in the United States, and that makes it also very interesting. Their reaction towards the state politics, the attitude of the people of America, and it's so different from ours. So it is extremely different, interesting.
And when you came back, did you have more work to wrap up the research that you did on the tour?
No, we sort of have this, in Apeldoorn, we have these discussions, these debates, and everybody contributes to that, and there will be a book about our different contributions towards the trip. But it has a huge impact in just a thought. The thing is that you get the grant, we go on the trip, trip itself is very stimulating, and you learn a lot, and later on you give lectures, you disperse the knowledge you have in the world in Holland by giving lectures. So it's not very direct, the influence, but it's indirect. Sometimes years after, when I went to Los Angeles on the same grant, then years afterwards someone said, would you have, just a critic, I was in the car, and he said, would you have made this plan if you hadn't been to Los Angeles? And I thought, what a question. And then I suddenly thought, no, I wouldn't have made this plan like that. It was about a strip, and it was very, you know, the freedom of America, which is lovely, because we are very rigid in our regulations. But that freedom, I suddenly realized, no, I wouldn't have made it if I hadn't had that trip. So that also made me very aware of the beneficial things of going abroad and meeting other people in another cultures.
So we'll see what the Grand Canyon inspires.
Just for example. Now, in any case, we were talking about natural landscape just an hour ago. That it's so breathtaking that the Grand Canyon on a scale we don't experience in Europe, and that makes it exceptional and also an icon for the Americans. But it is also very, very sad to go just beyond it, to see how a landscape can deteriorate and how dreadfully wasteful it can be used just, say, 10 kilometers further outside of the national park. And that's so sad, sad to see it. There's such beauty. The American landscape is so beautiful, and it's sometimes very, very matter-of-factly used and in a very coarse way and in a very wasteful way, spatially wasted, and not only architectural aesthetic, that doesn't matter, but spatially it does matter, because we have to be, in any case, in all circumstances, it's about, with world population growing, it's a question of density and getting to use our landscape in a more densely way and not in a wasteful and expanding way, but more in intensifying that what we have already. Our cities should intensify, and maybe our agricultural areas or our natural areas should be also quieter. Mm-hmm. And it tends all to be just as intensively used, those different, completely different phenomena. So that's what we have to fight, maybe.
I think so.
Yeah.
The fight goes on.
Yeah, the fight never ends, doesn't it?
I don't want to wrap up before you talk about your recent involvement with the Landscape Architecture Foundation, and the work that you've done to create the fieldwork catalog.
Yeah,
could you talk a little bit about that?
It was an initiative we did because we, in Europe, different from the United States. In Europe, we are all these countries and there are different cultures, and landscape architects tend to work, because they're grounded in their own countries, and there was very little, up till the last 10 years, very little contact in between the different countries in Europe, because it's not the United States of Europe yet, so and because of the language differences. I mean, it's only up to recently that the French speak English, I mean, and others speak Spanish. It is difficult to communicate. But I thought it was very, very important that we don't try to integrate Europe, which is very necessary, to integrate Europe on only an economical level and on a level of interchange of human resources, but also on a cultural level. And that means, that doesn't mean that we all have the same culture, but we have you can in the discussion and showing what the different fields are, you can enrich your own attitude towards landscape architecture. And in that field, we missed completely some sort of a review topos, and we had other things, but there were very little. So we started this book, Fieldwork. Anybody who wants can submit a plan, and a selection committee selects 40 plans, and out of these, lastly, we had 400 or 500 submissions, selects 40 projects, which show the state of the art, not more or less, and they also show the discussion of the jury, comes up some sort of topics or what is important or what are assignments which are the future, and those topics are translated into essays. We say now we should write an essay about our new problem with water or our climatic change or urban whatever it is in the cityscape or public space, what is needed at that moment. And so that compiles the book, and I'm going to do it 3 times as a chair of that selection committee, and then somebody else takes over, and then it will be an institute where there will be one of those institutes where there's more communication between the two, the countries of Europe.
Mm-hmm. Is it determined yet what topics seem most poignant in this fieldwork that should be published at the beginning of 2009?
It is very much like the last one about water, and about the change in the agricultural, in the regional changes about agriculture. We have very little plans on a regional scale, and it is sort of strange, to say the least. It's very difficult to show those plans, because they're very difficult to get into, to know what is really about it, but they're very needed, because our regions need a specific planning or attitude towards what how they have to change to meet the new conditions, and these plans lack completely. Mm-hmm. So we need those. Mm-hmm. And why are they not there? And why don't? And if they're there, why don't we show them in a very? It's also that's professional. How can we show our interventions also on a regional scale in such a simple way that anybody can understand mm-hmm. that? And they're so intricate and so difficult to understand, even for professionals. That's something wrong about that. Mm-hmm. So that was one of those discussions of what shall we do with it?
Well, we look forward to
the next one field work. And the next one.
And the next one after that. The last field work, what were the essays based on?
I can't remember exactly, but it was about water in any case, mm-hmm. one of that, because we found out that the northern countries had difficulty getting rid of the water, and southern countries had difficulty getting the water, and that meant a completely different project, because that's always the discussion, hey, in Europe. In Spain, it's about the discussion of architects and landscape architects. In Europe, it's always a discussion between north and south, the difference in attitude. But it is not only a difference in attitude, it's really the difference in climate, in land, and it's culturally very different. Latin is another culture than the Anglo-Saxon countries of the north. Really different. And the older I get, the more I'm aware of that, suddenly.
To wrap up, could you tell us briefly how you see your work and your practice in life evolving in the next 10 years?
I love my work, so I'm very passionate about that. So it's very lovely. I mean, if you have a profession, this is one of the love of this profession. Don't you agree, Craig?
Yes.
We work in an urban field. We work with green, which is always very much in contrast. You make a project and you leave again, you intervene, and it's in all ways it's very, very diverse, and it's very, you know, very gratifying. That's what I think. So I hope to be able to go on for a long while, and I must say that I think the differences that I found a very good equilibrium, balance between landscape architecture and urbanism, and I think that is quite exceptional, because landscape architects and urbanists tend to be two very different worlds, as we heard this morning also, but they aren't different because it's the same attitude of process. Urbanists tend to be more or less end plans, and this is what we want, and landscape architects by profession and by definition open processes if it's good. So I think that combination is very fruitful for me, and I like also the different attitudes, because in the world of urbanism is much harder, much economic, more economic, and much more money goes around, so it's much more about power and much fiercer. But the combination of that, luckily, with as landscape architecture, pure sang, traditional landscape architecture, is lovely. Really, it inspires me in both ways, because I think as a landscape architect quite hard in that field, in the green field, and in this world of big money, etc. I'm sort of a strange softy, and I like those roles, and I'm developing. It's also in my life. It's not about very different. It went also very gradually. It's also transformation. Every time I go from one step to the next, and it's not really a step. It's a transforming to the next phase, and trying out new possibilities. Mm-hmm. So it's lovely. It's very dynamic. It's lovely. So there's nothing wrong with this. I like my job, and I really enjoy it very much. The only thing is that I work too hard. I was talking to Gabrielle Keefe, and she says, "Oh, our problem is that we're passionate and we work too hard. We all have
don't
the same
know where to stop."
And Henri Lavard doesn't know where to stop either. He said, "I need a sabbatical year. I'm fed up. I'm just tired." You know, that's also the tendency that these people are, because they're. Yeah. so much demand. And that's a nice thing, Craig, because there's also a difference between the time when La Villette was there, to come back to La Villette, is that it is, at that time, it was still very much, you had to, not about the profession, that the profession was something that had to be defended. No, there was the work because of the economy, but also that the, and now it is, landscape architecture is a synonym with quality. So even if it's don't need anything, but I don't need to do anything here, it's all right, or just leave it, just leave that natural area, just take your hands off and just build here and just leave it. It depends very much, and that is a great difference, that there's a huge amount of work for landscape architecture, and there's a huge hunger for quality, and the quality now is very much, and that's really the future, natural environment. We are very much into wellness and into nature, into the healing power of nature and green, and that's sunk down very much into all these disciplines, and they use it in sometimes a very wrong way, but that's us to show that they're using it sometimes in a very consuming or in a very parasitic, parasites, like parasites using it, instead of using it in a positive and in a developing way and in a respectful way. But that's up to us. But first seed is that they're aware of that that's quality, that there is a chance for quality if you look at nature. So that's not, so I live in times where everything's very changing.
Yeah.
Just go with the flow. I always say, just see and look and where you can contribute. I'm not so an advocate, like I'm not a preacher, but I see what happens, and then I follow my intuition, and I say what I say, and in that way contribute towards the enhancement of our profession and enhancement of ecology and nature in a very urbanized world.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
It was lovely.
For this dispatch of telegrams, it's been great to listen to your history and about what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
Good luck to you. And good luck. Good luck on the prize giving, which is tonight.
Tonight, yes. Yeah.
We'll see.
There are a few projects I wouldn't choose, but there are many projects I would choose. And that's the difficulty.
Yeah.
With field work, we can choose 40, and then if it's 41 or 39 or 44, doesn't matter.
Tonight
really.
They need to choose one.
Just one. That's difficult.
That's a
terrible
challenge.
Yeah, very difficult. I would find it very difficult.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Greg, for inviting me.
Michael van Gezel, a Dutch landscape architect, is a self-employed independent advisor of landscape architecture and urban planning.
Gentlemen, good luck.
Thank you for joining us for the 18th Dispatch of Terragrams. Join us next time for a conversation with John Beardsley, senior lecturer at the Harvard Graduate School of Design, art historian, theorist, curator, and author of Earthworks and Beyond, Contemporary Art and Landscape. Special thanks to the books for their wonderful and still very cool music. You can expose yourself more to the books at www.thebooksmusic.com. To find out more about Terragrams and sign up for our next deliveries, please visit our website at www.terragrams.com or subscribe using iTunes. That concludes our 18th Dispatch of Terragrams. Thank you for joining us.
Are myself, April, Tammy, and Brad.
All the music is your name.